Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
We'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the river fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory to the battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we will explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its memorabilia in the Publishing and Broadcasting Network. And we're live from the Southport, North Carolina, home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I am Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150 years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at Gridiron Greats Magazine. At this time, I would like to introduce my co-host, the senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawks items, in particular Steve Larger. He has from Portland, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Captain, good to be here as always. Thank you very much.
We're back. Ed, before we get going into what we were going to talk about, I got a lot of from the latest issue of Gridiron Greats Magazine.
Yes.
And Dr. Bob Stevenson wrote an incredible article that received quite a few comments from longtime readers. Many of whom never realized that game at the turn of that century was a 0-0 tie. And they truly appreciated reading about the history and seeing some pretty old photos and pieces from the Ohio State Archive Department in relationship to that particular game. So a shout-out to Dr. Bob, longtime senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, guest many, many years ago on our podcast. He comes out with 1 to 2 articles a year. When he does, they are very, very deep, in-depth, and a great view of Ohio State football history. So I just want to get that in before we get started. And again, very, very excellent, even if I say so myself, edition number 74. That just came up. I just want to add, if you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for?
Exactly.
A topic we're going to talk about, we've talked about it on several occasions over the years, but we're doing a review of older card sets as we close out the 2021 season going into 22 season of our podcast. Tonight we're going to talk about the 1948 Bowman football card set. And before I hand it off to you, Joe, I'm just a couple of brief points I can make about my own 1948 Bowman football card collection, which unfortunately is in storage right now. I took many, many years to finish that set. The set itself basically grades from poor to VGEX. I have no cards that are better than, in my opinion, X plus. I have a handful of X cards, several poor cards. Again, for me, collecting those sets, that set back in the 1980s, 1990s, I could not find the divisible by three cards anywhere. Those were the ones that held me up the most to finish the set. Maybe at some point I'll upgrade. There are several cards I definitely want to upgrade in that set because they're much more available today than they were 30 years ago. But it's a great classic vintage football set. It's a small set. It's a small card set. And it's the beginning of Bowman. Now, Joe, I'm going to hand it off to you.
Yeah, I love the set, these little black and white beauties. And it's just, you know me, I'm a 48 Leaf fan. 48 Leaf is one of my favorite sets. But this black and white 48 Bowman gives them a run for their money. And it's interesting, like when PSA decides, you know, which card is the rookie card, you know, between the Sammy Baugh and Leaf or the Bowman. It's interesting. The majority of them are Leaf, unless there isn't a Leaf card, like this, Alex Wojciechowicz, card, et cetera. But it's always interesting because, the Leaf is obviously a colorized and animated, sketch from, an actual photo, from a real photo. Whereas these are the real photos. So, I mean, what would you rather have? As a kid, you'd probably rather have the colorized version. As an adult, you kind of want a picture of their, of the actual person. So it's kind of interesting. It's 108 cards in the set. We know that they were printed on three sheets of 36 cards, four rows, nine cards. Years ago, I saw I saw an uncut sheet. This is going back to like 2014 or so. I saw an uncut sheet, and I wasn't, I was collecting uncut sheets then, but it actually kind of took me by surprise. I saw it the day before the auction ended and then forgot the auction ended and missed out on it. My second place, my silver medal is I own a 20 card partial sheet of, a uncut sheet of the 48 Bowman. And I've put the numbers together. They go in skip set. I mean, like mine goes number 1, 4, 7, 10, 13 across the top. And then underneath it goes, 28, 31, 30, and then they run by 17. So it doesn't go by team. It doesn't go by anything. It's really weirdly numbered, skipping three, going in thirds. Don't know why. I've never seen a pattern like that. But the nine, any card that ends in a multiple of nine is considered to be the short print in this set. So for example, I'm looking at the PSA registry right now. The number nine card, the Nolan Loon, hang on here. Let me get to somebody who's got mostly a PSA set. Fab Frank, who I've known for a long time. The card number nine in PSA 8 is a pop 10 versus you go to the card above it, which is the Kenny Washington card number 8. That's a pop 23. It's almost double it. And then if you go card number 18, Vince Venonis, it's a pop 11. Card number, 27 is a pop 9. So, I mean, you've got, population, 9 to 11 in multiples of 9 in divisible by 9. Which coincides with four rows of nine. These are edge sheets. So, I mean, but something about that right border, got the crap kicked out of it because it's not the equivalent of the left border, which would be card number one, card number 10. It's double it. Card number one, Joe Taransky is pop 18. Card number 10, which would be the left border, is 22 pop. So obviously that right border that right border got the crap kicked out of it during the cutting process, which is odd. You don't see that, but
And I gotta stand corrected. I think I said divisible by three. I meant to say divisible by nines. The nines trying to find the divisible by nine, not by three. I stand corrected on that. Were very, very difficult to find, and those were the last cards that I needed to finish the set, and they were brutal to find. Now, what's your theory? And I know we talked about this probably a couple times, and I remember at one national. We were actually talking about it. What's your theory why that right side took that kind of abuse, that kind of damage more than anything else?
Wow, you're used to the side cards taking a hit, and especially the top cards. So if you think about it, card number one would be it. But I was explaining to you, I'd almost have to make a sketch and submit it. How the sheet's laid out.
Yeah.
It's divisible by a nine is damaged, but I'm looking at my sheet. These don't lay out one through nine. So it's not like the top row, of the sheet is one through nine. So I'm in the process of numbering what my sheet goes and how it goes. But and that's the problem is I've got a partial sheet. So I'm kind of extrapolating how the rest of it lays out. But I get the feeling, and there are some divisible by nines that are more populous than others, but you take the card number 108, Buford Ray, there are six of them in a PSA 8. So it's definitely a corner card.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm getting at is the 48 Bowman sheet isn't numbered, 1 through 9, top row, 10 through 18, mm-hmm. second row. In other words,
Skip numbered every which way.
It's skip numbered. Yeah, thank you. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah, it's skip numbered. And the logic behind it, we really have no idea. I mean, we truly don't have any idea. And we've talked about it, and I've talked to other people about it, and they really have no gathering why or understanding why it happened. The one thing, though, that this was probably about 5 or 6 years ago, and I don't know if we ever talked about it or we did talk about it. There was a rumor that the reason why they were so oddly numbered, would it have been possible that that Bowman at that time did one of their non-sports runs combined with the football cards? Is that possible?
No,
I can't see
Ditto. The 36-card sheet that I saw was all football. And hang on, I'm running this out real quick. I've actually never 46-49. I've actually never thought about what it looks like if you run it out. Because that's 27. And again, it's not adding up. Divisible by nine. It's interesting because my sheet starts with one on my top row, which is five cards: 1, 4, 7, 10, 13. I assume I'm the first.
Okay.
I'm the A sheet. And since it's four rows of nine, and I started with one, I assume I'm missing the four, columns to the right. It could be 16, 19,
right.
22, 25. I would expect to see one of these borders ending in multiples of nine, and it's not. It's interesting. I mean, card number 45, according to this, or number 18 – yeah, what's interesting is I'm missing all the multiples of nine on my sheet. I have no multiples of nine on this Series A sheet. So maybe one of the other sheets has it on there. It's fascinating. I've never broken into how this is laid out on the 48 Bowman sheet until, I have it numbered, but I've never extrapolated out. Like I said, that's kind of interesting. Is there another sheet that is short printed? Because we've only seen
one sheet.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you use the theory of three, 36 still going to be, you'll be at the 108, but it still doesn't, it's not logical where the short printed cards are from. Am I right or am I wrong? Or am I figuring it out wrong? So if
no,
you have a 36
no, you're right.
card,
you're right.
Yeah, so if you get three 36-card sheets, that's 108 cards. That's the set. How did all those short prints come? Why did they come into being? I don't know. I mean, it doesn't make sense. So could it have been a third sheet that was just all the odd number, I mean, the divisible by nine numbers printed, and for whatever reason, it didn't get printed enough. There weren't enough of those sheets printed. I don't know that either, you know? So
yeah.
It doesn't make sense. It really doesn't make sense.
Anyway, when you think about short print, you think about how it was loaded into the cutting machine and how, and if it got damaged on a side rail. Or you think about the last card in the set and the kids putting the rubber bands around it, stuff like that.
Ray,
this is interesting. And this is what's funny is when you stop and take time to dig into,
And the big question could also be, did all those divisible by nines, were they a separate cut, and they got ruined for whatever reason? And therefore, they never got into circulation as much as the other cards. Who knows? I mean, that's one thing I never really could understand about that set and where the nines were. You know what I mean? And as you and I got to know each other more and you were big on the uncut sheets, you would have been able to piece together at least something from this sheet A, but still it's not enough information to really say where did those short prints end up on, I've always been curious.
Often it takes somebody like you and I to start to grab a sheet, to figure out how it's laid out. I think what would solve a lot of this, Bob, is there's a PSA article I read a long time ago that mentioned, that there's an uncut sheet that's found. And I mentioned, I don't have a scan of that sheet. The only scan I have is of my, is of my 20-card sheet.
Right.
So maybe
right.
I need to find
right.
that sheet and then, lay that out because they,
right.
if we had that, we'd be able to see how it's Ray Poole. There's Ray Poole, card number four, which I've got. Okay, that's interesting. All right. I'm going to dig into
this a
little bit more. I get the feeling there's a B sheet or something like that that's filled with short prints. That maybe is a short print sheet. Maybe there weren't as many of them printed. These aren't laid out. These aren't laid out, four rows of nine to be conducive for, your ninth card and your ninth row or column, was getting the crap kicked out of it. Interesting.
And the one thing I really don't I never could really put together, and now years later I can, I've had enough time to think about it over the years. In the 1980s, the Beckett Guide came out. That was basically the last word in anything football cards, blah, blah, blah. But I never could understand that. I always wanted more information. Well, why is this one short printed? Why is that 64 top short printed? Why is this printed? Why is this short printed?
Yeah.
This doesn't make any sense to me. How did you end up with all these short printed sets? It just didn't make any sense to me. Oh, and now years later, I have a lot more evidence and a lot more discussions on it. So it makes a lot more sense to me, but still, the Bowman, 48 Bowman, I never could understand the theory of the ninth. And unless it's seen on a sheet and or there is a completely separate sheet that was truly short printed, then we'll never know until it's out there.
Yeah.
So
I'll dig into this. I'll update everyone. And I'll update everyone because let me see if I can find that sheet. I'll post up on VFC and see if anyone has a link to when it.
Now, did you?
Interesting.
One other question I was going to ask you, and I would normally ask you about uncut sheets. Other than that 20 card sheet, you've never seen an actual full sheet in auction, right? For the 48.
No, because the PSA. I just looked the PSA article up. It's basically the link, on the when you go to the registry.
Right.
They have a, read a short story here. And they said in 2006, a full sheet was sold at auction. They don't mention the auction house. So now I've got to go back to the bigs And, you know, if it was like a Legendary or a Mastro, then, you know, we're SOL because they took all their data down, you know. So I'll dig into that. Amazing. I'll see if anyone got a copy of a couple of sheet collectors. By the way, an uncut sheet, a modern uncut sheet, like a 2008 metal chrome or something like that is for auction right now in the Mile High. And it's about triple what, you know, what a normal vintage sheet would go for. So oddly enough, there are other people out there who are collecting sheets, but they focus kind of on the modern stuff, which is interesting.
Wow. That is interesting.
There's others among us. There's other collectors.
Mm-hmm. They're out there. Well, all right. Our special guest is here, and I'd like to introduce him. Our special guest tonight is a dentist in private practice in Beaverton, Oregon, and has been in practice for the last 9 years. He was born and raised in Eugene, Oregon, and is a graduate of the University of Oregon. He's been a football fan ever since he was a child. As a kid, he became a huge Joe Montana fan and swore off the 49ers when they traded him. When he retired, he became a Carolina Panthers fan as they were a brand new team, and they had several college players on their roster whom he had followed. He also loves the history of football, and as a result, loves reading about other football leagues, especially the defunct United States Football League. His collecting interests include Oregon, Joe Montana, the USFL, memorabilia, and vintage collecting. I'd like to welcome to our show this evening, Mr. Richie Barrett. Rich, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Welcome, neighbor.
Hi.
Now, I gotta ask a question, get this out of the way. Joe, is
All
Richie
right.
your personal dentist?
No, he's not. Rich just joined VFC, about a year ago, Rich? You know, most people think of Oregon as, think of Oregon as that, you know, all the cities are so close you can get to them by wagon. But, Beaverton is probably, what do you say, Rich, about, you know, 15 miles away from Portland?
Yeah, probably. It's a good 30 or 40 minute drive anyway. We're pretty far apart.
Yeah. You know, now even longer if you encounter, you know, protesters or something like that.
Yeah, no kidding.
I find that a weak excuse. If I was going to ask Richie if I was out there, he could cap me some dental care or whatever, but I won't mention
it
now.
But anyways. I wouldn't be a very good customer. I don't have any cash.
Getting on to the,
I have a perfect
Richie, thanks for being on tonight. And I'd like to lead off by, if you could tell our audience how you got started collecting football cards and football memorabilia.
Sure. Well, I think it all starts with just, you know, being a fan at an early age. You know, I didn't grow up in a house with huge fans, but my folks loosely followed football when I was little because my mother's cousin played in the NFL for a brief stint. So football was always kind of on when we were, you know, growing up. And then with the Ducks getting good at the time, and obviously the Niners being good with Montana, it was just, you know, you became a football fan. And then I discovered trading cards from a friend of my father's who actually had owned a card shop in a neighboring town that had gone out of business. And I remember in his garage, at least my childhood recollection, is an entire, like, pallet of wax boxes of late 80s tops that he used to just give me and my brother. So I probably opened 20 boxes of 88 and 89 tops growing up, and it just sort of, you know, kind of grew from there.
Wow. What we would give for that pile of wax right now.
No kidding.
That's pretty cool.
What a heck of a
That's pretty cool. Well,
that's that.
Rich
that
and I just started exchanging.
Joe loves that 88 tops wax. I know that. So,
Wow. Well, it's funny for me. I always loved the 89s. That's what I remember most for some reason.
There was a,
and I remember,
I don't know if I've told this story. I've probably told you, Bob, but, you know, 15 years ago, a guy on the CU boards was selling a bunch of the 88, and he was selling it for like $5 a box, but shipping was $5 a box. And it wasn't worth that much back then. And he was up in Seattle, and I'm like, I'll buy that. $5 a box. But meet me in Centralia, which is halfway between Portland and Seattle. It's about 90 miles north. I said, okay. Well, I didn't realize what, like, you know, 150 wax boxes weighed. And I show up my old Ford Bronco. And we just start loading into it. I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. And it just, I just start stacking and stacking. I'm like, oh, my. And I have to bucket the seats down. I had to put it in the passenger seat. And I just, you know, by the time I was done, my car was loaded. And I was just, you know, you could see it sitting down low. You know, it took me 2 days to unload it in my house. And yeah, I wish I had those boxes now. I'd be driving down to BBC, you know, BBC's and getting granted. But Richie, you and I are both mutual Oregon Ducks fans. I mean, we've exchanged a few texts about where our seats are and, you know, meeting up at a game. And, you know, I'm you know, my wife's, I didn't know if I told you, my wife's, you know, was on the, you know, on the endowment committee, you know, for years. I mean, she actually, yeah, so we used to go to a lot of, you know, sit up in the president's suite and stuff and watch games. Anyways, your passion, your collection of Oregon Duck items, you know, tell us about a few of them and how you came about getting them.
Sure. So, you know, first of all, I kind of grew up in the 90s. I really kind of came into Oregon football right when they were, kind of had that miracle Rose Bowl run in 94, which I was, I think, 9 years old. So that particular season sort of stands out as, like, the greatest sports moment of my childhood, and that Rose Bowl game especially. So I try and anything 94 Oregon, I'm all over. And recently I came into a possession, I was able to purchase a player ring from the 95 Rose Bowl. That was given to a defensive lineman who was relatively known at the time. And that's kind of the core piece of my collection. I'm really quite proud of that one. I found it out of an estate from a jewelry store in Canada, of all places. I'm not sure how they got it, but they did, and they were able to make a deal and get a hold of it randomly, Canada, yeah. So that's kind of the big piece. You know, I've got a few game-used balls, a couple other random things. One really interesting thing, though, is, again, that 94 team being so special, and Joe, you probably remember back in those days, they used to put out like the little helmet stickers for big plays, like Ohio State did today, right, the little round stickers. So I got a mini helmet, and I took a bunch of pictures I found online from the Rose Bowl. I actually recreated the quarterback's helmet from that team using little homemade half-size scale stickers, and I have a mini replica of his helmet, who was my favorite player on that team, and I was able to track him down. He signed it for me. So it's kind of a unique little piece of my collection. It's special to me, but probably worthless to everybody else. And I think one last cool one. I'm a photographer, sort of a hobby, and 25 years almost to the day after that 95 Rose Bowl, I was at the Rose Bowl watching Oregon beat Wisconsin, and I took a spectacular picture of the stadium with the sun setting and colors in the skies, and I had it framed with my ticket. You know, so that's a pretty special piece to me as well.
Have you showed a picture of that? That sounds cool. Really, really beautiful.
I don't know if I have or not, but I can post the pictures up. You guys can check it out. I'll do that today, if I remember.
Awesome. Man, that sounds cool. You know the famous phrase at Autzen Stadium, you know, that they always announce.
Oh yeah,
Never rains at Autzen. I've got a few pictures of some real rainouts.
Well, you know, when they played Stony Brook earlier in the year, and it didn't rain, but it monsooned before the game. I don't know if you were there at that one, Joe, but there was a spectacular rainbow over the stadium before kickoff. So they got a pretty spectacular photo of. Which I should probably post as well at some point.
Well, really cool. Yeah, they usually start the schedule out with what I call their bye week, you know, which is they play a weird team, you know, like Stony Brook with their weird team this year, and it's their bye week. So yeah, I always joke around. It's a high school, but yeah,
I can only imagine how much they paid Stony Brook to go out there and play. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, what was the
score? Yeah, it was six figures for sure. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah. I know it was pretty high. It was pretty bad, to say the least. Richie, you got a lot of stuff in your collection. You got a lot of different pieces. Can you name for our audience your top five items and describe them also?
Sure. So, I kind of mentioned the Rose Bowl ring. That's pretty high up on the list. Quick description, 10-karat gold, large player's ring. Because of NCAA rules about value, though, it couldn't be totally encrusted with diamonds. So it's cubic zirconias. It's got some tile work in it. It's got a big O in the middle, a duck on the side. It's, for being mostly synthetic stones and 10-karat gold, it's really quite impressive, though. It's real pretty. Kind of other facets of my collection as far as vintage football cards, I would say my best piece is definitely my 65 Namath rookie. I have one. It's not super high-end. It's a PSA 4, but I love it all the same. I have a long-term goal of putting the whole set together, but the Namath is about all I've got at the moment. So that'd be number two, I guess. Number three, I have a really cool USFL game use piece. I'm not sure if you guys remember an old Bengals tight end named Dan Ross, but he was an All-Pro a couple times in the early 80s and finished out his career with the USFL playing for the New Orleans and then later Portland Breakers. And I happen to have his game-used Breakers helmet, which is kind of a cool local Portland artifact because he played here for a season. But also really cool is that, if you can see on his 85 USFL Tops card, he actually modified his face mask. He wanted a little more visibility. So he took what looks like a hacksaw and cut the top bar off his face mask, giving himself a kicker-style mask, which is pretty cool. And like I said, pretty evident on his Topps card. It's unique looking.
So describe that face mask one more time. What did he do with it again?
It's like a three-bar face mask originally. But he took what looks like a hacksaw based on the cut marks and he cut the top bar off. So it's a real mask down by his chin almost. But, I mean, he was a tight end. So just must have been a tough dude.
Okay.
And like I said, if you look up the 85 top USFL cards that he's on, you can see it very clearly what he's done.
Okay. All right. I got to check that out.
That one's kind of neat.
Nice.
Another interesting piece, which I picked up not too long ago in an online auction, is it's a game-used NFL ball that was used in the Week 1 1990 Monday night game between the Saints and the 49ers. And on one panel, it's all painted up because it was Saints defensive back Toy Cook had intercepted it. It was one of the balls he kept because it was a ball he picked off. And I bought it because I realized, it didn't say this in the auction, but if you go back and look at the game, that ball was thrown by Montana. And it's an actual game-used Joe Montana thrown football.
Wow.
And if you think about it, a Montana interception ball is probably rarer than a touchdown ball because it's about half as many. So that's kind of an interesting one. I display it on my bookshelf with the painted panel backwards so you can't see it. And I have a little label that says, Montana game-used ball. But, it's an interception ball.
That's a funny way to think about it. That an interception ball is worth more than a touchdown ball. That's kind of funny.
And maybe not.
I like it.
Maybe not worth more, but definitely rarer. Because I think you threw 139 picks to 270 some touchdowns.
Yeah, good point.
Anyhow,
wow.
So that's kind of a fun one.
Cool.
And finally, I'll give you one last one, a fifth one. It was a modern card. I'm a kid of the '90s, so I love modern-ish stuff. And that junk wax era, there's not a lot of really rare things. So if you can find a really rare thing, that's pretty cool. In 1995, when Montana retired, he signed an exclusive deal with Upper Deck, but he still had some cards with other brands, and Skybox got a little bit jumpy about having too many Montana cards, and so they pulled a couple of his really early in production and created a couple really scarce short prints. And there's two insert cards from his Skybox Impact product that are almost non-existent. One of them is their future Hall of Famer insert, which I was able to track down a PSA 8 example of. I don't have the other one, but I have the one. So It's kind of a unique and special
case. Wow.
You know, I got
you're,
like a
you're,
comment.
You're kind of all over the board.
There is no such thing as junk wax anymore or junk wax carts. I mean, to hear what was there through those years and how much the overproduction, yada, 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 all that. But there are carts like that you never even heard of, and they're out there, and you know, they're worth something. You know what I mean? It amazes me. It really amazes me. So I really don't call it junk wax anymore because it's not junk. It's valuable stuff, you know? It's amazing.
And as a kid of that era and remembering some of these rare cards, there are some real gems in the 90s, and there's not a ton, but there's some really cool cards out there for sure.
Yep.
Interesting.
Wow.
You've been collecting a long time. You've been, and what I always love hearing is just people's collecting stories because, you know, Bob's been, you know, he's the hobby stalwart here. But, I mean, you know, he's got more stories than most. But, I mean, it's fun to hear people's stories about how they collect stuff, how they bump into stuff, just like you're talking about that ring, you know, you found in Canada. Do you have any, you know, collecting stories you want to share?
You know, I don't really have anything other than what I've already said that is really that cool. But what I do have, as far as collecting, what I do have is, and some of you may already know this, one of my other hobbies is I create custom trading cards. You know, I've been doing that for 5 or 6 years. And that has had some really cool interactions because of that side of the hobby. And I'll give you one example here. I was doing some custom designs, posting them online, and someone reached out to me and said, hey, I really like what you're doing. Can I talk to you about a potential project? So I said, yeah, sure, what's up? He said, well, my buddy is the son-in-law of a Hollywood actor who'd been in a number of sports movies, and they want to do something special for Father's Day for me. He's in his mid-70s. And I said, okay, and would you be able to, you know, do a couple designs of his characters from the various movies and make them up for us? And I thought that sounded like a really fun project. The actor turned out to be a man by the name of Chelsea Ross, who probably his most famous sports roles were in Major League, he was one of the pitchers, and then in Rudy, he played Dan Devine. And so I ended up doing, 7 or 8 different designs, I think 7, done a design, they liked them, printed them up, and they ended up putting them like in a shadow box display, and they gave it to him for Father's Day. A couple weeks later, I got a really nice 2-page-long handwritten letter from this gentleman, Mr. Ross, and signed photo, and just really thankful. I was really cool. So that was kind of a fun encounter.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Did he say thanks? Was there ever like, hey, this is awesome? Or
yeah, I was very thankful. So this is really cool. He liked you because when movie characters don't have a ton of backstory, so I had to come up with a little bit of some backstory for his characters that he thought was pretty entertaining, statistics, like he was one of the pitchers in Major League, so I had to come up with a career statistics for him, and,
that was kind of
fun. Yeah.
That's funny. It's cool. I love that. Sometimes, though, the ones that they get made up are better than what they, what a Pops would come up with, just because there's so much more thought that goes into it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the truth is that I kind of found an old pitcher who was, because the movie kind of depicts him as an older guy towards the end of his career, good career but not legendary.
Yeah.
So I tried to find someone who was a similar type player and just sort of switched up some of the years and made a few creative changes and called it good. But he liked it.
Well, that leads me to the next question. How'd you get involved in creating those sports cards and give us a little background on them?
So I'd seen some people do it and post them online. I always thought that's kind of a cool thing. I've always been kind of a computer guy and I like playing those kind of stuff. But Photoshop had always been something I'd really struggled with. I tried it a few times, couldn't make it work. And so I kind of gave up. I reached out to some of these guys saying, hey, I would love to try this. But they really didn't want to give me any advice. They were very gatekeepery about how they did things. Kind of was at a dead end. and sort of put it on the back burner. I'll do it someday. Then my brother-in-law came to me and he asked me if I would be his wedding photographer because they didn't have a big budget, and I'm free because I do the picture stuff. And so I begrudgingly agreed. And then I realized, if I'm going to do this, I better learn how to use the Photoshop program so I can give them good pictures. So I kind of became really motivated to learn the software. And it sort of all kind of clicked in my head that I can learn the program by trying to design one of these football cards. That'd be a great way to learn the tools and how to do things. And so with a renewed sense of urgency, I just sat down. I kind of decided, I always loved 1967 Topps football, so I thought that'd be a good design to try and replicate. I picked that quarterback from Oregon from 94, who I like so much, and I said, I'm going to make a 1967 Topps style card of him. And I just sat down, and I went after it and spent a bunch of time doing it. And it really turned out I was pretty happy with it. And even better, it was fun. I had a good time doing it. I really enjoyed it. And I thought, I might want to do another one of these. And so I did a couple for my mom's relative who played in the NFL, who never had a card. And before long, I was just kind of churning them out, posting them online, and got a bunch of really positive feedback, and it just kind of grew from there.
Interesting. You mentioned the quarterback from 94, and that's Keely Smith, isn't it?
That's Danny O'Neill.
Oh, that's right. Oh, man. I got out of the Navy in about 94, and I had a good friend who had 8 season tickets to the Ducks, and we would load up in the back of his van and drive down, drinking the whole time. And we were horrible. I mean, 95, right after the Rose Bowl is when we started going down, where we lost to Penn. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I didn't really understand how it all worked. I'm a football fan, but I didn't understand. And they were horrible, through that little era. So kind of funny. They just started getting good. When Bilotti came on. What's on your want list? I mean, because you've talked about Joe Montana, you're working on custom cards, obviously Oregon Duck. What would be on your want list? What is what's that thing that you search for all the time?
Well, so obviously I'm all over the map with my collecting interests. So I'm always kind of keeping an eye out for unique Oregon items, especially game used stuff. Same thing for the USFL. But as far as like trading cards. There's one random little set from Proline, 1995 Proline. I check every day. They had their autographs, a big autograph set in that particular set or product. But they also had a set called Printer's Proof, which were like, they were like stamped like a red stamp, 1 of 400, and they had a parallel set of Printer's Proofs. Well, they also randomly made 8 Printer's Proof players, limited to 50, that were signed. So there's a small subset of Printer's Proof autographs with a print run of 50, and it was like 2 rookies, 2 young players, and a few veterans. And one of my goals is to put that set together, and I've got 5 of the 8. So I'm always looking for those 3 that I'm missing.
Who are the players in that set? Do you know off the top of your head, Richard?
I can certainly try. So I can tell you I am missing Trent Dilfer, Boomer Esiason, and Troy Aikman, the 3 I'm missing. The 5 I have, Kerry Collins and Steve McNair, who were the rookies, Drew Bledsoe, who was one of the young players. I have Emmett Smith, and there's one more that I'm blanking on at the moment. And if I look here really fast on my computer, I can probably come up with it. But, they were all unheard of back then. And I've been searching for years for these 8 cards. And, I'm getting there, slowly but surely. It's been a couple years since I've found one. But I can't find the last guy. I'm sorry, guys. I don't remember.
That's amazing. Something that small, something that overlooked.
Yeah.
And again, it's probably in somebody's junk box for all you know.
It could be.
You know, it's amazing. Truly amazing.
The fifth player was Steve Young.
I've heard of him.
Yeah.
I just couldn't think of it.
Wow. How'd you get into those? That's kind of an interesting set.
You know, when I was a kid, I liked the Pro Line issues, the 94s and 95s. They had about one autograph per box, so that was kind of exciting. And I remember one day just flipping through one of the Beckett magazines, and I sort of saw this little sort of blip at the bottom with these eight cards worth, at the time, book value were hundreds of dollars a piece. And I thought, well, that'd be really cool. And then when I got back into collecting about 10 years ago, I just decided that I was going to try and track them down. And I haven't found one for the last 3 years, but I do check periodically, or about once a week.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I
love that. That's something we've never heard of. It's their white whale. That always fascinates me. I love that.
Yeah, it's a broad hobby.
Yeah,
I look for cards for people. I definitely got to mark down those three cards. So if I ever somehow come across them, I'll get it and let you know, because that's amazing, an amazing set in my opinion. So obscure, I never heard of it, and to have those eight players in it on top of it, it's just that is amazing. And I can only imagine how many more of those obscure sets are out there. From, you know, again, from 89 up, you know, it's amazing. Truly amazing.
Yep.
I got one more question for you, because I know we're limited on time today. Ken, Ricky, give advice for a beginning collector in our hobby.
Sure. So, collect what you like. As we just talked about, this hobby is so vast. And there's so many different things you can fall in love with. You know, just because it may not be popular, if you like it, collect it. And that's what makes it so great. You know, you guys were just talking a little bit ago about 1948 Bowman. I never owned one. I really don't have any interest in owning one. But you guys are so passionate about that set. And then I have these 95 autos that no one but me's ever heard of, because I, you know, would do almost anything to find. So collect what you like, you know, and if it's not valuable today, who cares? It may be tomorrow, and what's valuable today may not be tomorrow. So don't worry about if it's valuable or not. Just collect what you like. But, you know, when you decide what you like, try and find the nicest example. It's better to have a small collection that you really love than a massive collection of stuff that's just there.
You know, Bob, I begin to notice a pattern. All the guests that we have, all the real smart ones say, collect what you like. I've always appreciated that, and I never, ever get tired of that answer, because I think that is that's the most true thing you can do. Right on. Richie, quick question here.
Sure.
About 2 years ago, right before this COVID thing kicked off, again, I mentioned my wife's was on the board, but we still go to a lot of their auctions. One of the auctions they had was a private dinner with some Hall of Famers. And it was headed up by Drew Bledsoe, who happens to live, you know, in eastern Washington, in a little town called Milton Freewater. So, and he's got a winery out there. So he got together with a bunch of other Hall of Famers. Put together this dinner with him and a guy you might have heard of named Dan Fouts.
Yep, close twice.
Hall of Fame quarterback. So my question to you is, I ended up winning this auction because obviously I wouldn't mind sitting down with Drew Bledsoe and Dan Fouts and a couple other guys, and I forget their names. They were good, and I know it's stupid. I should remember. So, you know, we had to skip it because of COVID, and they bumped it again this year until next year. But, you know, Fouts and Bledsoe are the two I remember.
if you had the chance to sit down for a nice homemade dinner, you know, on Drew Bledsoe's ranch with Dan Fouts, what would you ask him?
You know, honestly, I would be more interested in hearing about just, you know, Don Coryell's offense and what it was like to play in a system like that when it was so innovative. You know, I feel like Dan's experience at Oregon is probably not that exciting, in my opinion. They weren't that good back then. But
yep.
that Air Coryell offense was, for its era, something to behold. And so I would love to just get some insight into what it was like to play in that system when it was so new and so unique to the NFL.
I like that.
Wow.
Don't tell Todd
cool.
Tobias this, but I'm a closeted Air Coryell era San Diego Chargers fan. You know, how do you not like Charlie Joyner, John Jefferson, Chuck Muncy, you know, Dan, you know, take three steps straight back, you know, Fouts, you know, kind of guy, you know, not to mention Kellen Winslow out there on the end. Just what a team. You know, we're 400
mm-hmm.
yards of passing with an average day at the office, you know. Dan.
Right,
yeah.
In an era where that was just unheard of.
I've got a book that Todd wrote called, you know, Bombs Away. I think I'm going to take that and ask him to look at that. I'm not sure if he's seen it. So that's probably what I do. I was just curious because I haven't thought about what I'm going to ask him about, but I tended to focus a little more on the San Diego Chargers, Air Coryell era as well. I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a cool book. That's a good book. That's a good book. Okay, Richie. Any other final thoughts? I know you got to get back to work there. I don't want to keep you.
No, not really. I mean, I really appreciate you guys having me on. I was kind of nervous, but really excited to do this. And it's been a lot of fun. So thank you for just for inviting me on, and it's been great.
Well, thank you, Richie. It's great to hear about your collection, and you got some beautiful items in your collection, seeing the stuff on VSC and the like, and your classic cards that you make up at the same time are just so interesting to look at. And so they're so cool to look at. It's great. I truly enjoy them. Keep up the good work.
Sure.
That's all I can say.
Well, thank you. And, you know, if I'm always looking for ideas. So if anybody out there has any creative ideas for my next design, you know, shoot me a message. I'll add on the list. All righty.
I love it.
All right. Thanks, Richard.
Thanks,
Richard
guys.
Bear, a big Oregon USFL Joe Montana and an obscure 8-card autograph set from the 90s. Amazing collection.
He's starting to sound.
I tell you,
starting to sound like my intro at the beginning of the show, where it's like Joe Squire, Steve Largent, Red Grange, Seattle Seahawks stuff, just all stuff that's all over the board.
Yeah, well, you know, but that defines you, Joe. I mean, it's you know, you have a very young view of the Seahawks. You were there at the beginning. You know, you followed the history of the team, so on and so forth. I think that's pretty neat, you know, and in Richie's case too. We started with the Panthers when they were a new team. I had a good buddy of mine who actually lived outside of Winston-Salem at the time, and he was an original Panthers season ticket holder, and he would send me some of the stuff from the first season. And, you know, honestly for me, yeah, it was interesting to read, but it didn't do anything for me, you know what I mean? So you got to have the passion for what you're collecting. And I go back to the, you know, I go back to the year 89, roughly to 99. I look at that 10-year period of all the different card sets that came out, all the different things that came out, so on and so forth. I always said, I don't know how anybody's going to keep up with this stuff, but I also said, too, there's going to be sleepers in these boxes as the years go on. And if anybody had any foresight, enough storage space, and enough cash, you'd be buying wax boxes and just putting them away type of thing. So here's a good example of that 8-card set, which I knew nothing about whatsoever, really. I know he had mentioned it before on VFC, but, you know, I have no clue. I didn't even know they existed, but I'm wondering if they're, you know, they're buried in a junk box somewhere type of thing. So I find that pretty interesting. It's truly amazing. All right, I'm going to hand off to you, Joe. We're going to get ready for a two-minute wrap-up here. And before we do, Again, if you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? GridironGreatsMagazine.com. Joe, handing off to you on tonight's show.
And let's add to that, if you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats and you're listening to this podcast, you should visit GridironGreats.com and definitely sign up for the magazine. It's awesome. I'm looking at it right now. It's sitting on my desk. I read it, and usually I read it, and then I go back and reread it, and then I hit it one more time. Volume 20, number 74. Amazing photo on the front. Martin Jacobs, article like you mentioned. Just a great episode. In all honesty, Bob, I've always loved the editor's page. I read your editor's page note from top to bottom a couple times. I love your summaries because that's you. That's from the heart. I really enjoy those. Just my nod to the captain.
Well, I agonized about this issue's column several times. Brenda actually made me rewrite it a couple times. For the simple reason that I came down too hard on the 21 cards, the packs, and how much they cost, and yada, yada, yada. And I got to realize there's a lot of people out there who look for those cards. They go and they don't mind waiting and buying only one or two packs at a time, and they like opening them and they like finding the cards, so on and so forth. And I got to respect that, and I got to understand that a little better. I'm too much of a dinosaur in the hobby, I think, in a lot of ways, with the whole influx of cards beginning in 1989, and just doesn't seem to be ending. 32 years later, there's still a massive amount of new product out there, and I still don't know who's buying it. You know what I mean? I mean, if you bought everything from 89 to this year, you would have probably 20 times the amount of what could have been bought from 88 back. You know what I mean? And that's what I just don't get. I just don't understand. I really don't understand, you know. But it is what it is. I got to live with it, and that's it. And I got to say this. I opened up all my packs. I didn't keep them.
Oh, you did?
I broke them open, and I pulled cards. And I got to say this. On the Prestige packs, I got two packs with the same exact cards in them. I can't believe that would happen.
Nice. It's interesting. You know what? Both of us need to do a better job of not being, you know, the old man yelling, get off my lawn, when we talk about modern packs and stuff. It's just like our, you know, that's what I love about being on the show is just you hear about somebody's passion, just like what we, you know, mentioned with Richie. We haven't heard of it, but he's passionate about it. And that's okay. And good for you. What a nod.
Yep.
A nod to it. Just because we don't understand it doesn't mean we have to knock it. So, I mean, you know, ditto with, you know, opening up 2021 Panini. Gosh, remember I had that memorized, just what those packs that I bought, what they were called. And I bought some, you know, and I put them right on my shelf.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is that okay? Who knows? So.
Yeah.
You know.
It's really amazing. It's really amazing. So, all those packs I had bought down here that I was keeping on open, I just said, let me open them and see what's in them, blah, 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 and I did. And they were interesting to look at, and that's about all I'm going to say about them. It does not entice me to want to collect the set and or, you know, basically what I've been doing for the past few years since there's no tops anymore. If I do find pack of cards, I pick them up, I hold them, and that's it. You know, that's what it comes down to. All right, we're down to 30 seconds. Yeah, final thoughts.
Great show. Good guest. Thank you for putting this together, Captain, and your labor of love as a publisher of Gridiron Greats. Thank you.
Yeah, he's got a great passion for the hobby. It's nice to hear, and it was great hearing about his collection. All right, we're almost out of time. Again, check out our website, GridironGreatsMagazine.com. If you're not a subscriber, what are you waiting for? And hopefully we'll be back next week with another show. Thanks for listening.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.